Well, good evening, everyone. This is Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. If you're listening to us live right now, please click the follow button so someone knows I'm working tonight. I want to give a shout out first to the underwriters for our show, without whom I couldn't be doing this. Thank you very much to author D.D. Corbett, author of The Amaretto, A Florida Keys Sailing Adventure with a Little Touch of Murder. You can find her on Amazon. That's D.D. Corbett. I also want to thank Poise Pen Productions. They provide author swag, promotional gifts, and graphics to beat the band. We use them for all of our promotional items as well. And a special shout out to Robert Gregory Brown, who not only is a fine author of thrillers and mysteries, he is a very fine composer and musician. He created and plays our music. Thank you very much, Rob. Tonight, I'm going to just jump right to it. Barry Eisler is with us. He is just released his new book, The God's Eye View. If any of you have ever read any of his books, you know that Barry is quite a prolific writer. He's an award winner, having won the Barry and the Gumshoe, and has been on every best of list known to man. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Barry Eisler. Barry, good evening and welcome to Authors on the Air.
Hi, Pam. Thanks for the nice introduction.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome, and all of it absolutely true. I want to start right off by talking about The God's Eye View. I have been posting about your book for a while now since I got the galley out of NetGalley, and of course I know the people at Thomas and Mercer, your publisher. So this book is kind of different from what you normally write, because you have the Rain series that we're used to seeing.
Right.
However, I know that you have a lot of interest in this type of story from a personal standpoint, having been with the CIA at one time, and also you keep a pretty steady pulse on what's happening around the world. Tell me about The God's Eye View and why you wrote it, please.
The story is based on and inspired by the revelations of whistleblower Edward Snowden. Even a little bit before Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras and Ewan McCaskill in The Guardian and Bart Gellman in The Washington Post were reporting on Snowden's revelations, I had an idea for a surveillance program that would be extremely far-reaching and that I thought would make a good basis for a thriller. But my concern was that maybe it was so far-reaching that it was stretching the bounds of reality. And realism is really important to me because I find the scariest thrillers are the most realistic thrillers are
Absolutely.
The most scary. And also just because realism has become so much a part of my brand. So I was a little bit concerned that what I had conceived, this program called God's Eye, was maybe a little bit too much. And then I was in Tokyo in June 2013 researching and writing my previous book, Graveyard of Memories, when Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras their first articles appeared in The Guardian, and I was just electrified, horrified as a citizen, electrified as a thriller writer. And I realized that what I had been conceiving as God's Eye and that I thought might be going too far wasn't nearly going far enough. It wasn't even close
really?
To the reality of what has been deployed. Oh, yeah. So,
I want you to explain, though, because I had benefit of reading the book and going to all of these sites. Just let me explain. In the back of Barry's book, in this book, he gives specific examples of what you may think are not realistic things happening, but they are. So would you go and talk about the Guardian pieces, please? Because I think if you tie that in, it really is very impactful that way, Barry.
Sure. So one of the first programs that that The Guardian wrote about based on the documents that Snowden turned over is called X Key Score. And as Snowden described it, using this program, it's a search program. You can plug in someone's email address, and then if you're an NSA analyst like my character, Evie Gallagher, you can find all the online behavior of whoever is associated with that email address. You can find the websites they visit, the chats they've done, obviously their search history. You can call up their emails. You can you can get an entire electronic picture of what this person's life is like using this program. So that's the kind of thing that I hadn't adequately conceived because it is so far-reaching.
Now,
you want me to go? I mean, there's so many other programs that.
Because you actually use that name in the book, don't you? Or something similar to it.
Sure, and a whole bunch of others: X Key Score, Prism, Executive Order 10233, or 12333.
Is it hard to find these things? Is it hard to discover that these things are real? I mean, you research as a rule because you're – okay, so that's where I'm going. Let's talk about that a little bit because it's fascinating to me. It scared the crap out of me. I told you I'm putting tape over my camera on my laptop right now, you know.
That's a thing. That's absolutely right.
So let's talk about those things.
Well, look at
it like this. Okay.
So just recently – in some public remarks, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper said that America's intelligence apparatus might start using the Internet of Things to spy on people. When people talk about the Internet of Things, they're talking about everything being wired into the Internet, cars, refrigerators, clothing, your washing machine, flashlights, name it, everything connected to the Internet. This is what's popularly known as the Internet of Things. All these things throw off data. They can all be monitored in various ways. There's a passage in the book where the director is talking about not just the things that the NSA is able to see, but the things that it's able now to overhear. So, for example, there's a ton of research showing that you can turn cell phones on remotely, turn them into microphones. If they're off, you can use them to listen in. Think about things like baby monitors, about devices that are coming on, like, what is it? I forget what Amazon calls it. It's this digital personal assistant, and Samsung has the same thing. It's a little box that sits in a room, and you can just talk to it. And ask,
it regulates,
hey, what's the
your
weather?
Life
hey,
and everything.
How do
right,
I get to what's
right.
the traffic like?
Right,
yeah,
right.
It sounds like it could be convenient, but that thing is just sitting there. It's a microphone in your room. When you're at your monitor – your monitor is almost certainly fitted with a video camera. This, together between the camera and the microphone, is awfully close to what George Orwell envisioned in 1984, the telescreen that every house was fitted with. So this is the technology that exists. And part of what's interesting is the way we react to these things. So what I mean is this. If the government were to try to pass a law such that we would all have to get up an hour earlier, we'd have to go to work an hour earlier, everyone have to eat an hour earlier, like everything in our lives would have to be doing that an hour earlier, and the government tried to pass that law, there'd probably be a rebellion. But when that law takes the form of daylight savings, we don't have any problem with it. So a lot of public reaction has to do with how you pitch something. Similarly, if the government decreed that all citizens henceforth would have to carry tracking devices such that the government would not only be able to determine at any given moment where we are, but would also be able to go back in time and see every place we've been.
Yeah,
if the government
right.
tried to pass a law like that, again, I think it's safe to say there would at a minimum be really strong pushback. But we voluntarily carry these extremely convenient devices called smartphones with us everywhere we go, even though those devices have, as a feature, GPS tracking that can be used to determine our location in real time and also to create a map of every place we've gone over the last week, month, year, whatever. So the technology exists. And then the question is, what's going to be done with it? And you don't have to take my word for this. We just have to listen to the NSA. One of the slides that Snowden gave to the press outlines the NSA's aspirations for information collection. And that slide says, what does the NSA want to do with regard to all electronic behavior, all electronic communication, information? It wants to collect it all, partner it all, sniff it all, exploit it all, and know it all. It wants everything So if you combine the kind of technology that exists today and that is consistently becoming more widespread, more refined, you combine that with the NSA's own articulated aspirations, everyone should be concerned about where this is going. You'd really have to have your head in the sand or be in denial about human nature and history to feel otherwise.
And the interesting thing is they couch it all in beautiful language first, personal safety, national security. God forbid, you know, you worry about a child getting kidnapped, so put a bracelet on them with a tracking device. Have you read Jeff Deaver's The Steel Kiss? It's new.
I haven't.
Okay. You were talking about, you know, the all the appliances in the house being smart appliances, and he does a lot of the same thing. That's what it's based on, a serial killer who uses technology like that. But so it's an interesting thing. So in the name of national security, and for we're looking out for the bad guys, too bad if the good guys get swept up too, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's the nature of bulk surveillance. Everyone is being monitored. So what is the expression that thoughtless people and propagandists like to use to dismiss this state of affairs? They say, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. It's a pretty good soundbite, so I have to give people credit, whoever came up with it. It's a good soundbite. But if you think about it for just a minute, you realize how absolutely insane it is. First of all, it's not about hiding things. It's about privacy, which any human will recognize is a fundamental human need. And if I'm wrong about that, if anyone wants to argue with me about that, the first thing I want you to do is send me your passwords to all your social media accounts and your email accounts. You can reach me at Yeah, people might be concerned that I might be trying to steal, but you know what? You're right. I mean, it's like, well, if you got nothing to hide, you got nothing to fear.
Sure.
But just send me the passwords to your social media account so I can see what your messages say and who you're talking to, all that sort of thing. And by the way, I hope you're going to stop closing your bathroom and bedroom door when you're in there. Obviously, you're not going to be locking those doors anymore. Here's a thought experiment to prove the point. Say you're at a cocktail party, and everybody's sitting around the table. You're having a good conversation, dinner party. Everyone's enjoying the conversation. And then one guest says, you know, this conversation is so interesting to me. I'd like to just record it so I can listen to it later. And that guest takes a dictaphone out and puts it on the table. What happens to the conversation at that point? We all know what's going to happen. It changes.
Sure.
People start watching what they say. They start thinking more carefully. They start censoring themselves. They become more conformist because they know a record is being kept now of what they're saying. It's just human behavior. Even people who say, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, get outraged when they get hacked. Eric Schmidt, chairman of Google, happened to him. He was very upset. Mark Zuckerberg, head of Facebook, said that we may have to reconsider our attachment to privacy in our new digital age. Well, what did that guy do when he bought a house in San Francisco, Palo Alto? He bought all the properties around it because of why? Privacy. Privacy is important.
Sure.
Come on, Mark. If you got nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, right? It's silly. So anyway, it's not about – citizens don't have secrets from the government. What we have is privacy, and it's very important that we're able to protect that privacy from the government. If we can't, our relationship with the government – fundamentally changes. And today we're living under circumstances where increasingly the government knows more and more about the citizenry and the citizenry knows less and less about the government. That dynamic is fundamentally incompatible with government by the people.
All right. It's interesting. I recall having a conversation with Caroline Kennedy, who wrote very passionately about the right to privacy. We were at a luncheon in New York, and the Patriot Act had come into play. And I was very nervous about that. It made me very uncomfortable. And I said, you know,
because anytime the government calls something the Patriot Act, they're bullshitting you. Sorry.
Right. That's okay. It's true. I understand that. And, you know, people say, but it's for national security. And the fact of the matter is, I think that these particular laws have writers who say, let's come up with a good title for it. And to put people on the defensive so that they think that they are listen, September 11, I think, was an anomaly. Could we have stopped it? No, I don't think so. I don't think we can do anything to stop anything right now. I don't think anybody can stop anything. We're not forewarned enough. There's too many places for things to go wrong. That is the nature of the kind of country we are. But I think the government, and I'm not saying any one person in particular, but the NSA scares me. And I think that they're very clever about how they create catchphrases for what they want to do in the name of national security, in the name of patriotism. Does
sure.
that make sense?
Well, anytime you're going to roll out, right, anytime you're going to roll out a product, you want to make sure it's got an appealing name. So for sure, naming an act the Patriot Act or the Freedom Act, another clever one. Yeah, definitely. That makes it a little bit more difficult for your political opponents to argue against it because, hey, man, what are you, unpatriotic?
Right.
One way of telling when the government is bullshitting you along these lines is this, just a rule of thumb. I don't know that I'd say it's true across the board, but in general, when something is being named ostensibly for its purpose rather than for its means, like what it's supposed to accomplish rather than how it works, you're probably, at least to some extent, being bullshitted or propagandized. And here's just a really quick and dirty example would be the Department of Defense, the Defense Department. It used to be called the War Department. It was called the War Department because war is what the War Department does. The Defense Department is supposed to be is more a goal or purpose. Why do we make the war? Well, it's to defend ourselves, supposedly. So when you move away from what the organization does and toward something about what it's supposed to be accomplishing, you're probably getting bullshitted. The National Security Agency itself is a premier example of this. An honest name for the National Security Agency would be the National Surveillance Agency, because surveillance is what the NSA does. Security, what part of the government isn't in some way dedicated to the security of the American people? They all are. We got Homeland Security, we got National Security. These are fundamentally dishonest names. Central Intelligence Agency, pretty good name. You get a pretty good idea of what they really do. Justice Department, pure Orwell. It's supposed to be outcomes of justice, just like the Ministry of Truth and the Ministry of Love.
Interesting. Now, you were briefly with the CIA. I love the name, the Directorate of Operations. And every time I speak to someone who like Jason Matthews, who talked a lot about that, the name, and several other people who were with the CIA, did that experience fundamentally change how you felt about our government and what it was doing to the population?
You know, the sexy answer would probably be yes, but the truthful answer is no, not that much. It was a really interesting experience. It was a really interesting experience for me. But I was a lot younger. I was there from when I was maybe 25 to 28 years old, I think. So this is almost half my life ago. And I would say that my worldview was pretty thoughtlessly patriotic, kind of nationalistic. I looked at America as a benign actor. What's good for America is good for the world. We only want what's best for the world. And to the extent anyone is against us, it's just because they don't understand how beneficent and well-intentioned we are. That was pretty much my worldview at the time. So everything I saw at the CIA at the time was consistent with that. I mean, sure, this is a pretty powerful organization, capable of assassinations, coups. It has a paramilitary force, and it's got a lot of reach.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought that was all perfectly fine because I knew in my heart that it was all being used only for good purposes. What really changed my worldview happened quite a bit later, and that was exposure to the blogosphere. That's really it. I used to get all my information through various establishment media outlets. And for anyone who's reading, say, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, or watching Fox and CNN, or reading The Atlantic or The New Republic, Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, you might think you're getting a variety of information, but you're really not. The best way to understand all that information is it's, with certain exceptions, is going to be largely tinged with an establishment worldview. And it wasn't until I stumbled across the blogosphere about, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago at this point, that I started getting a really different way of looking at the world, really started exposing myself to media criticism. I wish I'd discovered Noam Chomsky earlier, because he's the best, and he's always been around. But for whatever reason, it was the blogosphere that that radicalized my politics.
Interesting. Let's talk more about your book. You gave what I at first thought examples in the extreme, particularly with the director. Do you ever envision anything like that happening?
Yeah, you don't really have to imagine it that much. What I sometimes tell people is, if you think that some of the government skullduggery I describe in The God's Eye View is far-fetched, just Google COINTELPRO. That's spelled C-O-I-N, like coin. COINTELPRO, it stands for Counterintelligence Program. So just Google it, read the Wikipedia page, and what you'll find is that COINTELPRO was an FBI program that ran through the 50s, 60s, and 70s of domestic surveillance and sabotage of the civil rights movement, student groups, anti-war groups. They spied on a couple of senators, Muhammad Ali. This is the kind of thing the government will do when it senses dissent. I mean, when you hear phrases like national security, think about how a phrase like that gets used. We absorb, close to 500,000 tobacco-related deaths a year, and it doesn't rise to the level of national security. We're apparently able to endure in the neighborhood of 40,000 annual firearms deaths. Again, no national security implications. automobile deaths, somewhere between 30 and 40,000. This is a lot of people dying every year.
Sure.
And yet national security doesn't even come into it. But a few Americans get killed by people whose skin is brown or whose religion is Islam, and suddenly it's called a national security issue. Roger Cohn in the New York Times actually described ISIS as an existential threat. That's a quote to America. Now, the kind the charitable interpretation to Roger Cohn in this instance is to suggest that maybe he doesn't know what the word existential means. But he does know what it means. It's even worse that he would think ISIS poses an existential threat. That is to say, a threat to the existence of America. 3,000 miles long, east to west, a population of maybe 325 million, the most powerful military the world has ever seen, the strongest economy, etc. And this little pipsqueak group is threatening our existence. That would be sad if it were true. Anyway, these things get ginned up by people who either are just emotionally unstable or somehow profit in one way or another from fear, and none of them are true.
War is big business, isn't it?
Of course. Smedley Butler wrote a book about it shortly after World War I. It's called, I highly recommend it, it's called War is a Racket. It's a short book. The principles are eternal. They'll never change. And one of the things that interests me about political discourse in America, and it's probably true in much of the world, but it's just that I get my, as an American, I get most of my news here. America's my focus. It's this. People know, just by common sense and life experience, that let's say you go into a store and you try on a suit, and the salesman, you know he's working on commission, and he tells you, you look great in that suit that you just tried on. Well, maybe you do look great in the suit. It's possible. But you know to discount what the salesman's telling you because you understand that he's going to make money if he can persuade you to buy that suit. So you discount what he's telling you. You might seek some sort of disinterested third-party appraisal, but you discount what the guy is telling you. But when the government tells us to be afraid, we always just swallow it. There's total credulity. We never say, okay, maybe we should be afraid. Maybe it is an existential threat. Maybe it is a real national security threat, even though we're talking about just a few Americans being killed by terrorists. By the way, I just have to run up these statistics. You are more likely to be killed by furniture falling on you or by being struck by lightning or by killer bees or by intestinal flu or by drowning in a swimming pool. You're much more likely to die from any one of those things than you are by being killed by terrorists. How can it be under those circumstances that terrorism is a national security threat? It doesn't make any sense if you know what these words actually mean and you respect the English language. And yet, I lost my train of thought. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I want to move on and talk to you about writing. But first, let me just make a mention that this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. I am speaking with Barry Eisler, who is brilliant and has had a lot of life experience and writes some damn fine books. If you want to speak to Barry, please call in at 347-633-9609. I am willing to gift you a copy of The God's Eye View to the first caller. Barry, I want to know, you're a fairly prolific writer, and for the longest time, you were self-published, correct?
It's a mix, actually. I have self-published some short stories, and I got my backlist back and self-published that. So I am published, or have been published, pretty much every way that you can be published. First by legacy publishers like Penguin Putnam and Random House Valentine, then self-publishing, and now by Amazon's Thomas and Mercer imprint.
Why did you go back to having someone else take care of it? Was it easier? You have, I know, with Thomas and Mercer, a lot more flexibility than you do, and maybe time, than you do doing it by yourself. But I know that you blogged extensively about independently publishing. Why did you decide to go to Thomas and Mercer?
So the first thing I want to say, because this is such a huge topic and a really important one for anyone who is considering how to publish a book, if you go to my website, barryeisler.com, there's a link there called Resources for Indie Writers. I think it's under the For Writers link, but whatever, Resources for Indie Writers. And everything that you and I are going to talk about, Pam, is going to be there, but in a lot more detail.
So okay, I have posted your website, by the way, so it's there. If anybody wants to go and take a look, I posted it on all of our pages, so and it's really easy to find. Go ahead, Barry.
So the short framework is this. It used to be that there was really only one way for a writer to reach a mass market of readers, and that was by partnering with someone who could distribute paper books through brick-and-mortar bookstores. And we call that entity a publisher. And that was the fundamental, has always been the fundamental value add. If you want to reach a mass market of readers with paper, you got to have a publishing partner. Okay, that's it. Digital distribution has radically changed all that. When it comes to digital distribution, as opposed to paper brick and mortar distribution, a lone author has exactly the same distribution reach as a giant New York-based conglomerate. It takes a little work to get your head around that if it's a new concept to you, but it's true. So a publisher coming to me and saying, hey, Barry, we want to be your digital distribution partner, they have no more value. They have no more value to me when it comes to digital distribution than someone would have for me offering to sell me air than anybody does, because I already have access. That's what self-publishing means. It means for a flat fee of 30%. I have exactly what, by the way, any New York-based publisher would pay a retailer like Amazon for the same distribution. I have the distribution. I don't need to pay extra to get it from someone else. So that's one possibility. And then there's a kind of – so that's like the legacy world. Their biggest thing is paper brick-and-mortar distribution. In the self-publishing world, the biggest thing there is digital distribution in exchange for a much better per-unit royalty. If you self-publish, you're going to make typically 70% per unit. You sell a $10 book, you'll keep $7. In the legacy world, if you sell a $10 book digitally, you'll keep more like $1.75. So you're making about four times more per unit if you self-publish. So that right there is one thing to consider. Now, maybe you'll make it up in volume if you go with a legacy publisher. Or maybe paper is more important to you than digital. There's no one-size-fits-all answer to any of this. Anyway, Amazon publishing, in my mind, is and as distinct from Amazon's Kindle Direct Publishing, KDP, self-publishing platform. Amazon, in addition to KDP, the self-publishing platform, Amazon also has publishing imprints that are, in many respects, like legacy publishers, but also offer a lot of the attractions and advantages of self-publishing. So I think of Amazon publishing as a kind of hybrid. You get a significantly better royalty with Amazon publishing, at least twice what you get from a legacy publisher in digital, but not as good as you get in self-publishing. You get faster time to market. It focuses more on digital than paper, brick, and mortar distribution. So for me, the Amazon publishing angle makes a lot of sense, and my relationship with Amazon publishing has been the best relationship I've ever had with a publisher. I'm really, really happy with them. They've done a great job with my books. I've done 3 novels with them, published the backlist after I'd self-published it, wrote a few short stories that I was going to publish, but they've been doing so well that I've just wound up publishing other stuff with them that I'd originally planned to self-publish. They're really good. But that doesn't mean they're going to be the right solution for every author. And the reason I encourage people to go to my website and check out some of the talks I have done there online with Joe Conrath, some of the keynotes, you can find videos, some of the articles I've written, it's because there's a lot to think about if you're making a decision about how to publish something you've written. It used to be that there was no thought, or very little. You were really deciding, if you were fortunate and you received multiple offers from, say, New York publishers, you might go with one, you might go with another, maybe one advance is bigger or something like that. But fundamentally, every entity in the New York Big Five is like all the others. There might be some differences at the margins, but they are, by definition, marginal differences. There's a reason that the Big Five is called the Big Five. It's because they call themselves a club in the documents that the government produced in its antitrust price-fixing case against the big, at the time, 5 of the Big Six. And Apple, they call themselves a club, but you can also really understand the way the Big Five has always run the publishing world by understanding them as a cartel or a quasi-monopoly. So anyway, it used to be that you could only go with one or another, if you were lucky, of the so-called Big Five. Now that's one possibility, but you've also got self-publishing. You've also got Amazon publishing, again, a kind of hybrid. And there's no one-size-fits-all solution for all authors. It depends on a lot of things. Your personal goals, your needs, your talents, how important various things are to you, like delegating business decisions versus being in control, time to market, paper versus digital, a lot of things to think about. And the right thing to do is try to develop a framework so that you can make the best decisions for yourself.
Do you approach your publishing as a business?
Yeah, I hope that was obvious from what I was just saying. And I think many authors are
afraid to look at it like that. I think that many, especially people coming into the business, don't understand that you're creating a product. It's got to be, this is something that's got to be produced to the best of their ability. It's got to be wrapped in the right kind of wrapping, and it's got to be have a nice bow on it, and all of those things.
Well, of course, I think the way to look at it is maybe just this: if you're a talented cook and you make great meals, really great meals, but all you want to do is periodically entertain at home and make your delicious meals and serve them to friends, that's beautiful. Do that. But if you're going to open a restaurant, whether you like it or not, you're in business now. And you might as well run that business as well as you can, I think. Makes sense to me.
I agree. Sure it does. Let's talk about you and writing. You've had a really interesting life as an adult. Were you always thinking that one of these days I'm going to write a book? Was that always in your mind?
No, I wish I could say it was, because I'd sound a lot more imaginative than maybe I really am, but I have always been a good writer. I've always had a knack, a talent for writing since I was a little kid. I feel a little immodest saying that, but it's true. And there are a lot of things that I'm really bad at. So it's not, I don't want anyone who's listening to think I'm needlessly full of myself. I could go on and on about the things that I suck at. Writing isn't one of them.
Tell me one thing you suck at. Tell me one thing you suck at then.
You really want me to just stop at one? I suck at having a sense of direction. I don't think I'm very good at hiring people. That was something I learned about myself when I was in business. I was a pretty good lawyer, but I wasn't good at hiring people. I don't know why. I just didn't really have a knack for that. So that's two or three things.
But I'm not surprised that you were bad at math because you're a creative person. So, you know, most creative people aren't necessarily math wizards. I don't understand math myself, but I get that. So did you read that with
your... Yeah, so everyone, you know, we've all got hopefully different strengths and weaknesses. Sorry?
Yeah. Did you
Writing was something that I was always... Yeah. I've never met a writer who didn't. I read a lot, always have read a lot, starting when I was really small. And I was always pretty good at writing. I used to write short stories on my own. And when I was in, after I graduated from college and law school, I always, whatever office I was working in, whether it was the government or law firm or startup, I always became known as the guy to go to when you needed some writing done, whether it was advertising copy or a business plan or whatever. That was the kind of thing people would just come to me for because word got around. And I don't know why it took me so long to, and I always enjoyed writing, so why did it take me so long to put these very obviously related thoughts together? Okay, Barry, you're good at something and you enjoy doing it. Have you ever thought about trying to make a living from it? I mean, it seems like that's a pretty obvious path, right? But it wasn't until I was 29 or 30 and first living in Tokyo that this idea came to me, which felt like maybe it was a story idea, but not even a novel, just felt like a story maybe. So I started writing it, not really being sure where it was going to go. And one thing led to another. 8 years later, I wound up selling the rights to that story, and that became my first novel, then called Rainfall, now called The Clean Kill in Tokyo. So anyway, yeah, that's how I became a writer. And not a mathematician.
And not a mathematician. You've had some interesting jobs. I mean, you were a technology attorney, and you did a startup in Silicon Valley in Japan. You like the Orient very much, don't you?
Yeah, I don't know what it is. There's no real answer to it, but I mean, I've traveled a lot for the books. I've traveled in Europe and South America, particularly in Asia, and I've enjoyed pretty much every place I've ever seen on Earth to one degree or another, but for some reason it's Asia that just always draws me the most. I don't know why. You could come up with reasons, logical sounding reasons, but in the end it's like, why is blue your favorite color? Why is red or green? Who knows in the end? It's just the way you're wired, probably.
Interesting. Tell me about your writing process. Are you the kind of guy who goes to his writing office every day and pounds out the books until it's done?
I suffer from a lot of distractions. Yeah, I wish I were like that. I get more like that as the deadline approaches, which is now I'm moving into that dome with the book I'm working on now. So that's good. But there's a lot of stuff that... that really interests me in the world, and I spend a lot of time reading and thinking about some of these issues. So, like, the revolution in publishing is just something that that I find extremely engaging and important, and not just because I'm in the business, but because of the lessons to be learned about human nature and history. There's just so much going on in publishing, again, not just in itself, but also for what it means in the larger world, that I find fascinating. But then political things, too. I'm really disturbed by a lot of things that have happened in America over, say, the last 10 years or longer following the events of 9/11. We've really lost our way in a lot of ways. Or you could argue that we've found our way too much because, just for example, the notion that America is inherently a peace-loving nation is pretty absurd. If you look at our history, I think it's safe to say that if a Martian came down to Earth and tried to identify the most peace-loving cultures, America would not be among them. So after 9/11, what happens to an organism that's stressed out? And we've all known, like, what happens to you when you're stressed out, or people you know when they're stressed out? They lose their access to higher level learned skills and they default to more primitive personality settings. So what happened after 9/11? What happened? America defaulted to war abroad and surveillance at home, well, surveillance abroad too. Those seem to be our default settings. Torture is one of the things we degenerated into doing, and that concerns me a lot. I think if you listen to the rhetoric, for example, some of the rhetoric coming out of recent Republican debates where the various candidates are trying to outdo each other in terms of sociopathic cruelty. Oh, I wouldn't just bring back waterboarding. I'd bring back a lot worse. Yeah, you're a pussy, literally, they said that.
Right.
I would do this. I would do that. none of this has anything to do with a rational connection between policy goals and the means by which they're going to achieve them. These are people who have surrendered completely to their most primitive emotions. And I look at America as having done a lot of that following 9/11. In some sense, it's understandable. When you're hurt, you want to hurt back. It's how we're wired as people. But if you're a policymaker, it's important to resist those emotional impulses and listen to your head. Don't stop thinking. Focus on the goal and how you're going to achieve it. It's, you know, the essence of strategy isn't doing the thing that's best for you. It's doing what's worst for your enemy, regardless of how it makes you feel. You want to keep your eye on that ball, so to speak. And we completely lost sight of that with these wars, invasions, drone assassination campaigns, due process, free, indefinite imprisonment of people, including American citizens, and arguably most of all, with torture. These are emotionally driven policies that not only have nothing to do with actual legitimate policy goals, but are counterproductive from the standpoint of those goals. So one of the things I obsess about is thinking about, reading about, writing about, and speaking out about how America has lost its way, in particular after 9/11, and how we can get back to sanity and actual national security in this country.
So you talk about getting back on track. How does one go about doing that, in your opinion?
Yeah, I wish I had a silver bullet, you know, some magic button I could press and just make it all happen.
I threw out the TV, literally threw it out the back door. Literally picked it up and threw it out the back door. Couldn't stand watching it anymore. So I've been TV-less for 10 years.
Hopefully nobody was standing there.
No, it was a big yard. But
this is one of the most important things. One of the most important things individuals can do: stop getting your news from establishment media sources.
Right.
For anybody who's curious, I just blogged about this morning. There was this. So I don't want to be too hard on The Economist, because there's a lot I like about The Economist in certain areas.
I read that blog.
Rethinking. So The Economist has been against drug prohibition for as long as I remember. They came out in favor of gay marriage, I mean, a generation ago. They're very free thinking and even iconoclastic on a lot of different issues, and I salute them for that. But when it comes to war, they are absolute warmongering fetishists. They've never seen a Western war against an Islamic country that they didn't want. And it's fascinating to see what kind of nomenclature they use to argue endlessly for new wars. So they were in favor of the West's war against Libya in 2011, and that ended – it didn't really end. It turned out absolutely disastrously. It turned Libya into a failed state, as Libya has been in the middle of a civil war ever since then, with a huge humanitarian problem, and is now a breeding ground for ISIS. So what is The Economist calling for now? We got to go back to war in Libya, because now ISIS, ISIS, ISIS. And their argument for the new war is that, hey, maybe the war, maybe a little more war would be bad, but doing nothing would be even worse.
Barry, I want to interject right here to say, I read your article and I agree with what you say, but what I think problems with going to war is there's no plan afterward. You know, it's not thought out to its longest conclusion there. You know, what's the plan after you go and you depose someone, you get rid of the guy you planted in there 10 years earlier? Yeah. You know, what's your plan B there? So,
I don't think that's an unimportant thing to consider.
No, I think it's a very important
even thing. Marginally moral. Yeah, but there's something that might be more basic, just as human beings. We might want to think what the war is going to entail, regardless of what an exit strategy might turn out to be. So, for example, in our war in Iraq, we killed at least 100,000 civilians. Many estimates are significantly higher. We created 4 million refugees. Forget about exit strategies for a moment.
I don't mean an exit strategy. I mean who's going to take over afterward. And I agree with you. When I hear people say carpet bombing and all, it makes me crazy. We're going to carpet bomb Syria. Oh, okay, I understand that. You know, it's the, I'm not sure. matter what happened, you look at things in a very analytical way. I look at them on a way people become sheeple. They listen to talking heads.
Yeah.
It's the discourse in this country has been ratcheted up so high in the past 10 years that you cannot actually hear anything rational unless you back away from it.
Yeah.
Which is why I read books. I read a lot of books. I read about 400 books a year. I don't watch television. I don't look at mainstream media. I can't stand any of it.
You don't have time. Yeah.
Well, I do actually have time because I don't listen to, I don't watch television, but I do have a real good variety of reading in front of me. But I understand what you're saying. I don't mean an exit strategy for a war. I mean, when you leave a country, you know, you hope if you're deposing someone, you're not killing off the civilian population and leaving the ones that are alive so pissed off that they at least have, hopefully, a person in power who now cares about who they are ruling, who they are the president of. They care about their people. They don't want to go into another war. I mean, it just was horrible. It was horrible. The beginning of the Arab Spring seemed so wonderful, but, you know, too many people have died. War is too high tech right now. We're not just sending people in with, you know, single shot rifles and we're, you know, firing when you see the whites of their eyes. It's a very high tech war, and people are maimed from this. Cities wiped out. It's unbelievable to me. It's shameful. But, you know, I don't know what to do. What does Pam do as a citizen? That's what I want to know. What does Pam do? So you confront these things all the time. Yeah, well, you do. That's true. But, you know, I also have a radio show that I would like to think it's not a politically based radio show. I'm glad to discuss everybody's opinion. I think everybody has a right to free speech. I leave my Facebook page as public for everybody else to look at. I will say to someone, you know, this is not, we don't chastise anyone on this page. You can go play in somebody else's sandbox. You know, we'll have a civil discussion. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, I understand why you're thinking about all those things. I do too. I just am cautious about how I talk about them. You know, I'm cautious about it. But I like your point of view. I like what you're doing. I think you're the perfect guy to have a platform. You've traveled around the world. You have seen different cultures. I would imagine you've seen some that look very appealing. I don't know if they're more appealing than living here. Certainly when Russell Blake is on, he says, you know, he's happy to be on in Cabo. He has a great time there. It's certainly not any more dangerous there than it is in any major city in America. I understand how your worldview also, affects your writing. And that's what I'm interested in, how your worldview paints your writing. And I think this book, more than any of the others, at least that I can recall reading, The God's Eye View, really slams home what you are seeing. Yes? No?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, these are reality-based thrillers, and I try to just depict what's actually happening and then drop fictional characters into that setting.
So you said you get sidetracked from writing because you're looking at news, you're looking at the blogosphere, you're going to alternative sites to find your news. Do these things also, I mean, obviously The God's Eye View, there's your storyline right there, but in your Rain series, do those sites and the things that you are reading all the time influence how you're writing too? Even in
absolutely. That's my justification, or call it rationalization, for spending the prodigious amounts of time reading about, thinking about, talking about, writing about these issues that I do, right? Because they do wind up somehow or other in my books. I mean, The God's Eye View, I just couldn't have written this book if I didn't spend as much time immersed in these issues as I do. It wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
And it would, I think, whatever I might have written instead, if I tried to write a book like this without without knowing and thinking about the things that interest me so much, it would have been a much paler effort and not nearly as useful in terms of raising awareness of what's going on with the government. And it wouldn't have been as good a read.
So you have another purpose besides entertainment, the actual joy of reading and having someone read a terrific book. You really want to educate people with your book, correct? Or no?
Yeah, that's right. And the trick is not to forget, I think this is the trick, not to forget that first, this is a novel. It has to succeed as, it's a thriller, right? So it has to be thrilling. It has to be entertaining. If it doesn't succeed in that regard, it won't succeed in any other. If I want to just, if I have an argument to make, like the one I had about The Economist's warmongering this morning, the place for that primarily is my blog. It's a straight-up argument. I make the argument, I marshal the evidence. But a novel, a thriller, has to entertain. So I want people, most of all, to be entertained by my novels, and it seems like they are, so that's gratifying. But then I also would like them to come away with a little bit more than just entertainment, especially because the feeling of entertainment, after all, can be somewhat ephemeral. I want them to realize that there is something to this story that's worth thinking about. And for that reason, for example, I've appended an 18-page bibliography at the end of The God Made You. And the reactions I've been getting are really gratifying. So
a lot
of feedback along the lines of, yeah, I really liked your book, Barry. It was fantastic. And then I got to the bibliography and I thought, oh my God, this stuff is all real.
Exactly what I said in my review, and after I wrote the review in Amazon, after I first talked to you on the internet, I went and read the book list thing, and the guy said the exact same thing, that your starred review for book list, I think it was. He said the exact same thing. He said, wow, that really puts everything in perspective. But so it's a good thing you did that because, you know, if you wanted to make it a learning experience and open people's eyes, if they took the time, as I did, to go through all those sites, it really does. It's horrifying. It's scary. You know, it's scary when you're just one person out there. What is your next book? What are you writing about?
The next one's quite different. It's another standalone. It's about Seattle, a woman who's a Seattle sex crimes detective who was horribly abused as a kid, trafficked to America from Thailand. And I don't want to say too much more at the moment,
That's
but
okay.
I love this
That's
character
okay.
so much. I love this book so much. And I need to turn it in at the end of March, and it should be available October this year. And I'll just say this. I've never cried this much writing a book. I love this woman. She's fantastic.
Really? Now, are you going to – do you think she'll be a series character?
Oh, yeah. She's absolutely going to be back. She's fantastic.
You've got so many stories.
She's just way too conflicted and psychologically complex a character to do justice – for with just one book. Yeah, she'll be back.
Fantastic. Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that. Who are you reading? Whose book are you reading right now besides your, you know, working on your own book? Are you reading anybody in particular?
God, if you ask me that on, if you ask me that on any given day, you'll get a different answer, right? But the one I'm listening to in the car right now is called War. It's a nonfiction book by Sebastian Younger. I'm going to look it up right now.
Isn't he a journalist? Yeah,
I just can't remember the subtitle of the book. Is there one? It's just called War. It's about his experience covering an American an American unit in the Afghan War. It's fantastic.
Right.
That's nonfiction. The book I was listening to right before this one, I listened to a lot of books in the car. The one I was listening to right before this one is A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki, and it is just amazing. It's a work of genius, incredible book. Highly recommend it.
Barry, what's the difference between...
I read pretty eclectically.
As do I, and that's a good thing. I'm across genre. What is the difference to you between sitting down and reading and listening to a book? you certainly get your different.
Well, the most obvious difference is one you can do in the car while you're driving, and the other one.
Well, I don't mean that. I mean,
wouldn't be safe here, right?
Well, no, I understand that. But you know, do you like to actually read books, or do you prefer listening, and why?
Oh yeah, I love them both, and it's weird. There's a little bit of a meme out there. I don't really understand it. I've run into people from time to time who say, like, oh, you listened to that book? Well, you didn't really read it. That's cheating. It's cheating that you listened to it. I just don't understand that. I don't get it. I mean, I perceive
it's not cheating.
Every word I listen to.
The content is what counts. I understand exactly what you're saying. I can't listen to a book when I'm driving because I can't divide my attention.
Yeah.
I'm just single focused. Let's take a call and see what people have to say. Hi, area code 410. You're live on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi it's
live.
Carol.
Hi, Carol. You're live.
Hi, Pam. Hi, Barry. Let me turn this down.
Thank
sorry,
you.
I have you on the phone as well, listening.
Yeah, you have to turn it off.
Very interesting. I am really looking forward to reading the God's Eye View. And it really looks good. Looks like my kind of book.
Thank you.
And I'm really glad, and I thank you, Pam, for letting me know about Barry. How are
Absolutely.
You doing, Barry?
I'm good.
Good? Great.
I'll tell you what. I'm going to have you. You didn't buy the book yet, did you, Carol?
No, I haven't. I just reserved it at the library.
Okay, do you have an e-reader? Do you read e-books?
Well, I don't have a Kindle per se, but I do read once in a while on my iPad, the Kindle app.
Okay, I'm going to gift you with a book, okay? So do me a
favor.
Oh,
thank you, Pam.
Send me in my PM on my profile page, send me your email, and I'm going to send you a book tonight, okay?
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
And then what you have to do, if that's okay, thank Barry for writing a great book. Then after you finish, I want you to go in and write a review, okay?
I definitely will.
Make sure.
I definitely
okay.
will.
All right. You have any
All
questions
right. Thanks
for
so
Barry?
Much.
Thank you, Carol.
Okay.
Enjoy. Have a good night.
All right, Carol. Bye.
You too.
I like that. I like that a lot. So any favorite authors of yours, by the way?
Oh, God. I guess another one, if you ask me on any given day, I'll probably get a different answer. But so off the top of my head, there's a guy named Andrew Vax who's really terrific.
Yeah,
he writes super gritty. You know Vax, he's wonderful.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
She's not a novelist, but his wife, Alice Vax, used to be New York sex crimes prosecutor.
Right.
She wrote a book about 20 years ago called Sex Crimes.
Right.
I read that book for research for the novel I'm working on now, the one about the Seattle sex crimes detective. And it's a fantastic book, and it was hugely helpful to me as research. So I've gotten to know Alice and Andrew a little bit, and Alice very kindly shared with me the new expanded edition of Sex Crimes, and that's what I'm reading at home right now. And that'll be out, I don't know, probably in a few months or something like that. And it's excellent. So there's always a recency effect. Like if you ask me about writers, I'm just going to think of ones I've read or am reading, have read recently or I'm reading right now. Anyway, there's some. I really like Isabel Allende. She's great.
She's great.
It's funny. She wrote a thriller a couple of years ago, and she said something, and it was like this ginned-up controversy. I think it was ginned-up. She said something like she doesn't read thrillers because she doesn't really like them. And then, you know, predictably, a lot of thriller writers got irate. And my feeling is, like, there's no right or wrong answer there. It's like, I'll tell you what, I don't like NFL football. I did not watch the Super Bowl yesterday. I actually love the Super Bowl because the streets get so quiet. It's my special day to wander around and have the world to myself. So I'm grateful for football for creating that, but I'm not interested in it myself. I hope I haven't hurt anybody's feelings in saying that. I doubt that I have, because there's no right or wrong answer. It's totally subjective. Same thing with thrillers. I don't have to get upset. Anyway, so I felt a little bad for Isabel Allende at the time. And Isabel, if you happen to be listening to this, I want you to know I'm on your side. You don't have to write thrillers. I love your books. Totally cool.
She's lovely. She's a lovely author. I've met her at Books and Books in Coral Gables. Have you been down there for a book signing at all? Mitch Kaplan owns it in Miami.
Yes, I was there years ago. Yeah,
he's terrific. One of the best.
Yeah,
actually,
put reading on the map in Miami, which is nice and a joy to go to. You know, if you've had some interesting jobs, you are a very successful, highly awarded author. If it all went away, what would you do?
Well, you mean if I didn't even need to work for a living?
Is there something, other job you'd like to try, another profession, anything that's ever interested you that you think, gee, if this writing stuff doesn't work out, maybe I'll try this?
Well, nothing really besides writing, but if I stopped writing novels, I could blog full time. It's a struggle for me not to, because there's just so much material. There's so much to comment on, and I really enjoy it. So I'd probably be doing some kind of political commentary instead of novel writing. But if it weren't writing at all, and I were really, if I gave over to, like, if I were amoral and didn't think about the value, the utility, the impact of what I was doing, being some kind of political brand consultant would be something that would interest me. I feel like I have a knack for that kind of thing. But I don't want to do it because, I don't know, maybe I'd do it for the right candidate like Bernie Sanders or something.
You have no interest in becoming an elected official yourself?
No, I don't really think I have the stomach for it. It's just too hard to I've had a hard enough time in my life putting up with what I consider to be stupidity, venality, self-dealing. And you got to be able to overlook a whole lot of that if you're going to succeed in politics. I'm not saying we don't need people who are able to. We obviously do. But for me, trying to be one of them, the cost of that would just be too high. I don't think that would be a really good role for me.
Hey, Barry, what is something that we don't know about you that you're willing to share?
I really like to make tapioca pudding.
What other creative pursuits
I don't think anybody but my wife and daughter knew. I don't think anybody but my wife and daughter knew about that recently. But
I'm kind of letting that go. I don't even know how to answer that. So I want to ask you about other creative pursuits. I happen to know you're a very fine photographer and you enjoy that. Are there other things you like doing in the arts, in the creative end of things?
That's a nice question. I don't think I really have many artistic talents beyond just writing. I think that's pretty much it, unless I'm overlooking something really obvious.
Well, you carry your camera with you every place you go, don't you? You photograph a lot of stuff.
I've taken a few photographs that I think are pretty nice, but I think that's entirely a tribute to the technology Apple has packed into an iPhone. And it has nothing to do with the person taking the photograph. I wish I could take the credit, but I don't really know what I'm doing when it comes to photography. The camera does all the work.
You're so funny. Let me just take one more call. Hi, area code 404. You're live on the air.
Hello, Pam. It's Randy.
Hi, Randy. How are you?
I'm good. Mr. Easler, it's great to hear you this evening. I'm enjoying the broadcast. And
hi, Randy.
I just wanted to call and offer up a few kudos. I'm here at work, so I'm going to have to jump back in your conversation here to the beginning when you guys were discussing individual privacy and the points you were making on that. I just wanted to offer up a few kudos and say good job on bringing that stuff to the forefront.
Thank you.
I think it's important that we keep it in people's minds. The discussion you guys had on the naming of the various bills and things like that, all that's extremely important, and I just think that the fact that you are writing to both entertain and inform also deserves a few rounds of applause, because I think there's so much that can be done in this vessel, and I just wanted to say good job. I'm looking forward to checking out your latest work. And at the end of the conversation here, I was able to jump back in, and I heard that you guys were discussing audiobooks versus hard copy. And I, too, am an audiobook guy. I have to travel a lot while I'm working. So I consume most of my books through audio for entertainment, and I keep hard copy stuff for research and repetitive use. when I want to go back to it for reference.
Well, hang on just a second, Randy.
Sure.
Barry, is God's Eye out in Audible yet?
Oh, yeah.
Do you have
Audible CD, and I'm the narrator. I've narrated all my books at this point. And,
oh, how fun.
And, okay,
Randy,
so
how about if I send you a copy?
Pam, you asked
me? Go ahead.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I'm listening to you.
You should definitely send Randy a copy.
I'm going to. I'm going to send you a copy.
Yeah.
I'm going to send you the audio version, okay? And I know your email address.
It'll
be my pleasure. I have your email address, so I'll be glad to do that, Randy.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah, Randy, I hope you enjoy it. I narrate all the books, and Pam, you asked me if I was good at anything else artistically, and I couldn't really think of anything. But I think I'm a pretty good narrator for the books, and don't take my word for it. The New York Times itself had some kind things to say about my voice talent skills. So Randy, I hope you enjoy not just the story, but the narrator's rendition also.
Oh, well, I'm absolutely looking forward to it. I really am. And again, I've enjoyed the conversation this evening, even though I've had to kind of bounce in and out a little. But the points that I were able to catch, those, you know, like I said, I've really enjoyed it. And again, kudos. I think that that sort of thought and effort is something that it isn't required to have a good book. But if you can get a double whammy like that, I don't know if it's better that the reader know it or not know it in the moment, but if they walk away after the fact and say, maybe it just changes their perspective just a little bit, I think that might be a good thing.
It changed mine. It changed mine completely, Randy. So I can tell you that it changed mine completely simply because, pardon me, when I first read Barry's book, I had it on my Kindle. And so naturally, I start at the very beginning, very first page. I read every single page in a book. I read all the, you know, the Library of Congress numbers, how to give the copyright and for everything. I read everything in a book. It's interesting to me. So, and at the back, there's all these pages. And so I just went for my Kindle right there and switched all of them on, scared the crap out of me. So, you know, I said to Barry at the beginning of this conversation before we went on air, I said, you know, I have the paper book now with the press release for the book and all. And I love it when publicists do that because there might be something in there I don't know. But I said we're kind of throwing that away and just going to have our own conversation. And that this is where it took us. It took us to the thing I think interests both of us an awful lot. But I'm glad you listened in, Randy. Thanks. And I'm going to go ahead and gift you with a copy of the audiobook.
I appreciate that. And just one other thing. I know that you guys, again, the discussion topics from the very beginning were just really good. And I don't know. I think it adds Pam, you know, this is kind of a crossover topic for me. I mean, you know the world where I live most of the time. Not necessarily that I'm on board with any all of that stuff. But, I mean, the ideas that you guys are discussing this evening could certainly straddle the line between those worlds and just the straightforward political world too, you know. So I just found this topic very interesting. So kudos to both.
Thank you. I'm so glad. Thank you so much, Randy. And Riley Love, okay? Give
all
a
right.
big hug to Riley and talk to you soon.
Take care, guys.
Bye. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Barry, it's been a fun conversation. I'm really glad that you came. I've taken way more of your time than I should have, but I would keep you here longer.
No, thank you.
If I was a indecent human being, I would be here longer. I love having the conversation. I wish we could do it more. Will you come back again one day and really talk about writing to everyone? Because I think that you have such a keen eyeball for that and a good perspective and a good experience, too. And you've certainly spoken about
that. Thank you for saying so.
My pleasure.
I would
Thank
love
you
to come
so
back.
Much.
Let's do it again for the next book.
I would love to have you do that. And just for those of you listening, tomorrow night I am with James Lee Burke. I tell you, it's simply the best on
all the
air.
Great. So that's another one. See, it's a reason. Please give him my best. I love his book.
I shall.
And speaking of audiobooks.
Did you read the new one?
Will Patton.
Will Patton.
Not yet.
Yes.
Will Patton reading James Lee Burke is one of the great combinations in the audiobook world.
Well, this book is just such a magnificent landscape for his so good as a wordsmith. I don't even know, his prose is just so exquisite, his command of the language. So I'm really excited, and I think it'll be a lot of fun. And on Friday, I'm with Anne Voss Peterson, who I know you know Anne also, because she does write with Joe. She's great. Yeah, she's funny as anything, and
awesome.
I can't wait to have her. Yeah, she is. I shall. And come back, Barry, okay?
I'd love to. Thanks for the invitation. Good talking to you, Pam. Thanks for having me on.
You too. Have a good night. Bye-bye. All right, folks, you've heard it here. It's been an incredible night of dialogue with Barry Eisler. It doesn't get much better than that. I hope you have a nice evening. Join me tomorrow night with James Lee Burke and on Friday with Anne Voss Peterson. Thank you very much for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. And a word from our sponsor.
Hey everyone, I'm Reagan Black. I write action-packed romance, giving readers an escape to live the adventure with characters you want to call friends. And with the happy ever after of each story, you can always savor the ultimate affirmation of true love.